Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal. I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Captain Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Good morning, Mark.
Hey, Francis. You know, I always wonder when we say good morning to everybody if people realize that for us at 11 o'clock, it's really morning for us.
You just rolled in with a cup of coffee and plopped yourself down a moment ago?
I'm a tea drinker, but yeah, that's what I mean.
We're actually just saying good morning to each other. We haven't had like a production meeting before this. Mark was playing with his kids and I was asleep.
11 a.m. is our time to get up and start our day.
All right, we have some big news. We have sort of a last-minute wine dinner coming up at the restaurant. We rarely plug events at our own restaurants. We sort of try to be a broader show, but this guy, Jano Di Grazia, who's been a guest on the show, he and his brother Marco Di Grazia run one of the most important and best Italian wine importing companies in America and around the world, just found out that on Halloween night, Jano's going to be in town, so we convinced him to do a dinner at the restaurant, and he's going to come, and we're going to have dinner and pour six or seven of his wines. It's $125 a person. His wines don't come cheap. But it's going to be a lot of fun, and it's very bizarre. This is our first ever in 15 years of doing wine dinners at restaurants, our first ever spooky Halloween wine dinner. So if you want to get away from the kids, leave your bowl of candy on the porch, turn on the light, and come to the wine dinner, have some adult fun.
Don't forget the take one, please sign.
No costumes necessary. Yeah, I was always wanted to be the first kid there with the take one, please, you know?
Because you're a bad kid.
No, actually, I didn't, but I always wished I could. You know, somehow my father was always in the back of my head, you know? I don't know.
Yeah,
still
not everybody's
is,
like
way.
That.
Yeah. Okay, here's in most ridiculous news, we have Safeway has come out with a new line of organic products. You know, Safeway has an organic line, which is commendable.
Organic, that's great.
Well, and it helps people.
We like to see stuff like that.
Helps people find the organic products if that's what they're looking for. One I don't quite understand. We got a bunch of emails about Safeway's O brand is organic.
Mm-hmm.
Safeway's O brand water. Their organic water.
That's great. It's water.
How do you grow organic water? It's water is what it is. You don't grow water. You don't feed water.
Maybe they're smashing hydrogen and oxygen together in the lab. And
you don't fertilize water. You don't pesticide
well,
water.
Well, actually, in our country, yes, you do.
Wow.
We do that all the time. We pesticide water. We fertilize water. The Mississippi is basically one big giant river of fertilizer, isn't
okay,
it?
Okay, so this isn't taken from the muck of the Mississippi River, is the Safeway water. I don't get it, but whatever.
Yeah, we'll buy anything, won't we?
Well, you know, honestly, I think they have like the lemon scented water or whatever. That's,
mm-hmm.
But
so
that's,
it's the
look.
Scent
it's not your
of...
biggest. It's not your biggest concern. Worry about the vegetables. Okay. All right. Now here's another one. Here's a scary environment. We're gonna have a fun show, by the way. The first 9 minutes, we can talk about some serious things. But we have Liz Pearson, who runs the Savour Magazine Test Kitchen. She's going to come on and talk about some regional specialties. They test all the recipes before they put them in the magazine to make them work. And Liz Pearson
is responsible for the testing.
I want her to invite us over right before they do the cookie issue testing. That's what I want to have. But she has a lot of fall stuff, a lot of regional stuff.
This is a little known fact about Francis and me here is that we are huge cookie fans.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
So those of you who want to impress us, stop making us foie gras. Stop trying to, you know, we go over people's houses all the time, and they make us the most fanciful meals they could possibly
think
of.
Chocolate chip cookies would be great.
We love cookies, okay?
Actually, some of you guys,
there it is.
Most of you guys send us mail. Most of our loyal listeners send us mail emails, which we love, by the way. Send us email anytime. It's francis@restaurantguysradio.com or mark@restaurantguysradio.com. We love to know that you're out there. And some of you guys actually send us old-fashioned letters. Listen, if you can do that anyway, put that letter in a box of cookies. Send it on down. We'll review your cookies.
The post office will ship cookies. That's not a problem.
We'll eat your cookies on the air. Okay, now, a year after the USDA began, here's your government at work. A year after the USDA began investigating how the United States supply of long grain rice became tainted with an unapproved for eating transgenic or genetically modified variety of rice, which continues to disrupt U.S. exports. In other words, none of the other countries want our rice now.
I need to stop you for just 1 second. Just 1 second. Okay, we're creating rice that's unapproved for eating.
Yeah.
Does anybody think that that's not a great idea?
Mark, the USDA got right on that. When they figured out that Bayer's unapproved for eating rice was out in the market, they immediately approved it for eating. Thank God they're there. Okay. It was unapproved, and then they're like, oh, my God, what do we do? So, but the other countries in the world have said, no. So U.S. rice farmers are in quite the pickle because we can't sell our rice anywhere else. There have been a few countries that are now letting us test some exported rice, which is very expensive. And when we find some, and most of it's contaminated, when we find some that's not contaminated, we can sell that rice, but that testing is very expensive. And the only countries, little entities that haven't signed on to that and so are still not buying U.S. rice, just a couple of small entities, the Russia and the EU, which were the largest consumers of American rice. So,
except for Americans.
Right. Well, that's the problem. We don't eat that much rice here.
Right.
So that's the problem. Now, the USDA, when they found that this transgenic rice got out there, they immediately rushed to solve the problem by, approving it for eating, even though it hadn't been tested sufficiently to get approval beforehand. 14 months now they've been investigating how this could have possibly happened, and they've determined that they cannot figure out how Bayer Crop Science, you know the Bayer Corporation, how Bayer Crop Science's genetically modified rice got into the food supply. Therefore, they have determined that they're not going to hold Bayer Crop Science accountable.
Right.
Hold on a second. Bayer owns
There's only one way that it got into the food cycle. Bayer messed up.
Well, and here's the deal. The way this is how crazy it is. The way our laws work, for the first time, you can patent food. You can patent part of the DNA. So Bayer Crop Science owns the DNA of that material.
Clearly, they're responsible for any.
But hold on a second.
Malfeasance.
When you used to crossbreed and come up and you'd breed new forms of rice, you could own that particular one, but the next generation of rice, if somebody used that to make more rice, you couldn't own it. If you sold someone the rice and they kept some for seed and propagated again next year themselves, you couldn't own life. That's the way our laws have
been. Well, if you sold somebody rice, that rice then begat rice, the rice that came in the second generation,
you
can do whatever you want with.
Right. That is how it has been since time immemorial, right? Well, now with genetically modified crops, when you genetically modify a crop, you own that seed and any seed in which your genetic modification exists, so all of its progeny.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there have been case laws. There's a guy named Percy Schmeiser. You can look him up on our website. You can look at the Future of Food with Deborah Coons Garcia as a movie that was about this. They own the material. So Percy Schmeiser was a farmer who didn't want to use genetically modified canola. Genetically modified canola got into his field and mixed with his crops, and somehow he had genetically modified canola against his will on his property. The courts found that even though he didn't want it on his property, even though he didn't put it on his property, because the genetically modified canola was on his property, he had to pay a royalty to the people who owned that sequence of DNA. So what they're saying is these corporations own the sequence of DNA. And if you make a profit on it, even if it's by accident or it gets in your crops and you make a profit, you have to pay them.
Mm-hmm.
But if it causes damage, they're not responsible. How does that make any sense?
Well, part of the problem here is that the USDA has no teeth, and we know that the USDA has no teeth.
The USDA is owned by the people who are supposed to be regulating.
Okay. And it also has no teeth. I mean, when it talks to the beef recall that just happened recently, basically what happened was the USDA said, can you please recall your beef? It's got E. coli in it. And so the USDA really suggested that the beef recall happen. You know, there's a couple of legislators and legislation in the books right now to give the USDA some teeth, and we'll give you more information on that in the future.
We'll be back in just a moment. We're talking with Liz Pearson of Savoir Magazine. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. Time is 11:15.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450 WCTC with The Restaurant Guys.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to the Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick. Liz Pearson is our guest today. She returns once again. She's the director of the Test Kitchen at Savoir Magazine, one of our favorite foodie publications, and also writes the pantry section for that same magazine.
Hey, Liz, welcome back to the show.
Well, you know, we wanted to wait to have you back on the show until the autumn came. So we originally thought, I don't know, second week of September, third week of September, first week in October. And autumn is finally here.
So it is, thank goodness.
So so what's coming out of this? What's been going on in the Savoir Test Kitchen for the readers to maybe look at home for their autumn and their holidays and their Thanksgiving?
Well, it's certainly been a busy time for us. The end of those issues at the end of the year when you start reaching the holidays, they get particularly, you know, recipe heavy, and so we're very busy in the test kitchen doing it. The funny thing is that we actually are testing turkeys, for instance, and roasting off turkeys in the summer, getting ready for the Thanksgiving issue. So actually now we're just finishing up the December issue even and focusing on a lot of roasting and braising and a lot of those the nice cold weather methods that we like to cook in at that time of year.
What time should we come over?
You're welcome anytime. I'll tell you, there's never a shortage of food around here. We're always trying to feed somebody.
Liz, we were considering, actually, we thought you guys might want to just change your October issue to the beach issue.
Really?
Yeah. Will global warming change the food selections at Savoir Magazine? It could be the latest implication.
Well, I would probably not be the expert to answer that question, but I certainly hope that there is still, as we move forward in the future, that there's still a distinct cold weather cooking and hot weather cooking. We'll hope for the best.
We're hoping that there still is an autumn several years from now. That would be nice.
Exactly.
So,
but it's been good. We've been doing a lot of, I know you guys always like a good scoop. So the December issue, which we're just finishing up, is going to have a lot of, there's a big roasting feature and sort of the how-tos of roasting. And, of course, we hit on that in the November issue, which is just out now because of turkeys, of course. And there's also a great way to roast a ham in there. But it's been, you know, roasting is that sort of quintessential method that if you've got that in your pocket as a cook, you can do just about anything because you can roast all manner of seafood and poultry and meat that you want. So.
Now, you know, the other thing that I'd like to point out, I mean, it's very hard for me to cook. And I love to cook at home. But, you know, I work 6 days, then I have a day off, and then I work for 6 days. And so one of the things that I find that I miss is if I have a week off at home, I will cook on Monday. And the way a cook at home works is you cook on Monday and then you utilize what's left. You know, you have ingredients in the house that you can pull from, and then you use a little bit of what you cooked yesterday to go on and go forward.
Exactly.
Restaurant folks don't get to do that because whatever I don't eat that night, like I go out and I buy food to cook that night, I cook it, I eat it, and I'm not home for 6 days.
Also, Francis and I are instant gratification guys, too. So.
I know what you mean.
But one of the things I liked when I would occasionally be home in the evenings is I would love to roast a bird or a piece of meat and then leave it in the refrigerator, and I will lunch off it for the rest of the week, or I will go and I will cut pieces of it off it, or take the bones and make soup. That's why I think roasting, if you're home 3 or 4 nights a week, you know, people think, oh, I could never roast a whole bird. You roast something,
sure.
And it lives on, you know, in many incarnations. You guys deal with that at all in the Savoir Kitchen?
Absolutely. And the great thing, too, is that roasting is not a method that requires careful attention for hours and hours and hours. It's the kind of thing that if you prep it right, which really is just a little bit of simple seasoning and making sure you have a proper pan to do it in and your oven's at a good temp, it's really going to take care of itself with just a little basting. So I think it's sort of the quintessential cooking method for people that are really in a hurry. And you can also, you know, there's ways to roast things in a really short amount of time. If you roast a small, say, 2 to 3 pound whole fish, you can do it in 20, 25 minutes.
Sure.
So there's great things to do, too, but I'm not going to lie to you. I actually, about 11 o'clock last night, was standing over the kitchen counter with my sweetheart picking out a roasted chicken that I had made over the weekend. And we pulled off some of the breast meat earlier this week and made chicken tacos. We, you know, we have thrown some in with chicken stock and made soup. You're absolutely right.
Sure, it's an omelet in the morning. I mean, there's
exactly
a million uses.
It's a great thing to have around for that. And it really, I mean, once you get it in the oven, and which doesn't take a lot of prep, it's such a simple thing that doesn't require a lot of attention. And so I think as busy people, you really appreciate having that beautiful roast that was easy to do, that's in your fridge, and then you can turn, like you said, it's a chameleon. You turn it into, a you know, 10 different things during the week.
Well, you know, it's funny. You pointed out something that I think when we talk about healthy eating, Mark, I know that your mother was a great cook, is a great cook, but when you were growing up, would cook a bunch of stuff on Sunday that would be available.
Absolutely.
When
she worked full-time, and she would spend Sunday or Saturday. If we didn't go to my grandmother's house, she spent Saturday afternoon just basically getting, you know, all the things set for the week. And sometimes what that would mean was a roast on Monday and leftovers from that roast on Wednesday.
Well, but if you if
sure.
you, so many people have cold cuts in their refrigerator, right? And you have turkey breast and you slice turkey
right.
breast with all sorts of stuff in it from the deli counter. If you roast a chicken on Sunday and you put that chicken in the refrigerator and you your family you can instill in your family the culture of snacking on like you did, isn't that a great snack and a much better than, you know, the Pop-Tarts
so
or the Cheez-Its?
So much better, and it's not full of salt, and it's not full of preservatives, and it also can take on so many different textures that, say, sliced lunch meat can't. You know, you can shred your chicken and turn it into, like I said, tacos or something else, chicken salad, for instance.
Or,
and whereas if you just have the sliced stuff, you could cut it up, but it's not quite the same difference in texture that you might, especially if you're eating it many nights in a row, that you might be looking for a change.
And it's got that kind of glue texture to it.
Exactly.
Well, and,
nobody
and,
wants that.
And let's remember, because if you have kids who are fussy eaters, you can slice it and put it on a sandwich
mm-hmm.
and have it be non-threatening food. Hey, listen, we'll be back in just a moment talking more with Liz Pearson. She's in charge of the Test Kitchen at Savoir Magazine. It's our dream job. 1450 WCTC time is 1125.
The place, Brooklyn, New York, post-World War II. An Italian-American woman named Catherine Lombardi cooks for her family. What's so special about that? Well, lots. Food was central back then. Good food handed down from the traditions of two countries. Food that filled the whole house with the sweet smells of garlic, tomato, and basil. No matter when you stopped by or who you were sure to be fed and fussed over. Catherine showed her love on the plate and out of the pot. Any who were lucky enough to receive it never forgot. This is Mark Pascal from the Restaurant Guys radio show and Stage Left. I've just opened Catherine Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, and its mission? To live up to the standards set by Catherine Lombardi. So come by the bar, sit by the fire. Have some fresh mozzarella and antipasto. The matagatta and tortelloni are amazing, and the veal chop will make you cry. Our wine list, of course, without parallel. We've got to live up to the standard set by Catherine Lombardi. You see, Catherine Lombardi was my grandmother. Come let me show you where I came from.
Catherine Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, 732-296-9463 or CatherineLombardi.com.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC.
Hey, you're back with the Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis. We're talking with Liz Pearson. She is the in charge of the Test Kitchen at Savoir Magazine. And if you don't know about Savoir Magazine, you can check it out on our website. I have a link to it. It's S-A-V-E-U-R. It is really one of the most intelligent foodie publications you're going to find. We were talking about roasting before, which is sort of in keeping with the season of Thanksgiving through Christmas. There's a lot of roasting. One of my favorite things to roast is, and it's very unpopular is in America, is goose. I absolutely love to roast goose. You
that's because every time you roast goose, you got to clean the oven.
Yeah,
It's true. It comes with its own ramifications, doesn't it?
Well, roasting goose and roasting duck are interesting as well because you get a lot of fat that comes off. You have to do it on a rack that holds it above the fat, and you got to keep siphoning the fat out of the pan if you roast them whole. But that duck fat and that goose fat, man, make some French fries the next day.
Unbelievable.
Extraordinary stuff.
Or fry a couple eggs in a little duck fat.
Oh, my, it's delicious. So what's roasting for the holidays that may be a little different than the turkey for the upcoming holidays?
Well, I tell you what, we actually did a really fun recipe. One of the sort of Thanksgiving features that you'll see in our November issue was done in West Virginia. The author, Roger Morris, who wrote this beautiful story, was visiting a family called the Canterburys in West Virginia. And one of the things that they have on their Thanksgiving table is this Coca-Cola glazed roasted ham.
You know
and,
what? That's actually on our Thanksgiving menu.
Uh-huh. Well, there you go, smart guys. Well, it was really, and talk about easy roasting. It was really, you're just sort of pouring the, you take the skin off and you end up pouring the Coke over the ham, putting it in the oven, and it sort of takes care of itself. You baste it, and at one point you kind of cover it with foil. But it's a really nice, I think, alternative to turkey, as you guys obviously have already seen. And
wow.
Then there's also, you know, you'll see in our December issue, for instance, we roasted pork shoulder, we roasted whole striped bass. I think all of those kinds of meats are so regal, and a beautiful roast of any sort is really worthy, I think, of the holiday table.
Hey,
so
we have to take a quick break, and we're going to go listen to the news. We're going to come right back and talk more with Liz Pearson about what's going on in the Savoir Test Kitchen and what you might be thinking about for cooking at home and how you might get some great recipes when we come back after the news. 1450 WCTC, the time is 1130.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Liz Pearson is the director of the Test Kitchen at Savoir Magazine and writes the pantry section for the same magazine. She's a returning guest. And we're talking about roasting for the autumn and the holidays. You know, I love roasting. You know, the other thing I love to do is I love to put stuff in a... I love cast iron cooking and I love crock pot cooking. But whether I roast or not, what I love to do whenever I do, like, small birds and things like that, I always sear them by searing them upside down in a hot pan, and then I turn them right side up again. Is that a good idea? Is that a bad idea? How do you get a crispy skin on stuff that you roast when you
That's
want it to
That's an excellent, excellent way to do it. Cast iron, of course, conducts heat so much and gets so hot, which is great. And searing, essentially, if you put a bird that was raw, that hadn't been seared at all, into the oven, you'll get some browning, but you're not going to get that beautiful, crisp, brown overall color that you're really looking for. So, you know, searing first in a skillet before you go into the oven does a couple things. It gives you a nice, even brown color to then work off of. It also kind of starts to heat the bird, even. Around, and so that kind of helps it so that it's not, you know, cold turkey, pun intended, when it goes into the oven. So now, of course, turkeys, when we say bird, I think I'm referring to chicken, and I bet you are too, or chicken or smaller things. It's a little tricky to sear off a turkey, for instance.
That actually might be fun to watch, though.
It might be fun to watch, but would be a little tricky to do. It'd have to be an awfully big cast iron skillet. So really, but you're talking about with smaller birds. So Cornish game hens, or if you had chickens or that sort of thing,
chicken,
it's always
pheasant.
Great. Even for that matter, any kind of small roast, small pork shoulder or a pork loin would be great to sear off as well in a really nice hot pan on the stove and then go into the oven. It'll just help you get that sort of beautiful golden crust that you're looking for in the end.
A lot of people miss that, but I mean, another big favorite of mine is I love to do leg of lamb. I think leg of lamb roasts are great and also great to live in the refrigerator that you can slice things off of.
Oh, they're fantastic. And you know, I think we're going to end up running this wonderful recipe on the website in December that's going to kind of link to the December issue for this leg of lamb roasted with a little bit of piment d'espelette, the ground espelette powder, which is a ground, basically kind of a slightly spicy powder. That goes over the leg of lamb, and then on a potato fennel gratin. And that is, you're absolutely right, that's a great thing to have and slice off of. I mean, the lamb sandwich is 10 times more delicious than that sort of cut deli meat that we were talking about.
By the way, the espelette powder, you should take a look at that. We'll try and find some information and throw it up on our website as well, and we'll link to Savoir. I was at a Pierre Gagné restaurant, the Michelin 3-star restaurant, one of the best restaurants in the world, and they have on their table, this is how cool it is, right? And this is one of the best restaurants in Paris and therefore one of the best restaurants in the world. On the table there's salt, pepper, and a little bit of espelette powder.
Oh,
so that's how
wonderful.
And it's cool stuff.
Liz is on the cutting edge. It's really versatile, and there are great mail-order sources for it. So definitely that's something that your listeners should look into. We also discovered with something like leg of lamb, one thing we've really been working on lately are putting together really good carving notes for people, because the second part of roasting is knowing how not to tear it apart, you know, either in front of your guests or even just for yourself. You really want to know how to cleanly, beautifully carve it. And with leg of lamb, we found that if you have your butcher remove the pelvic and tailbone from the leg of lamb, when you come down onto the end of the leg there, or actually I guess it would be the top of the leg, the medius part, you won't hit that bone anymore and you can get much more even slices. And that's such an easy thing. Your butcher will know what you're asking for when you mention it, and it makes things so much easier at home.
Leg of lamb, I think, and my family, we made leg of lamb as long as I can remember. It's one of those great underappreciated cuts of meat. Even still today, I think that there aren't enough people, you know, embracing leg of lamb.
Well, the thing is, and I think the toughest part of leg of lamb in particular is there are a number of different muscles in the leg, and so that is a particularly hard thing to butcher properly.
Right.
And so, do you have advice in Savoir Magazine's coming up on butchering?
There is. There's going to be actually for every it's really kind of a cool thing. For every roast recipe that we include in the December issue, there are also going to be step-by-step photos for how to carve it and also instructions on what to ask your butcher to do. For instance, if you're roasting off a standing rib roast, if you ask your butcher to remove the chine bone and then tie it back on, you can roast it with the chine bone so that you still get the flavor of that. But then at the end, after you untie the roast, you remove it, and it's so much easier to carve straight down. So we have carving notes on everything from carving a whole fish to carving pork shoulder, sort of getting around the bones of things.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really, I think it's so helpful for folks to know, because you have this beautiful roast in front of you, but if you don't know what to do with it, it becomes a little tricky.
Yeah, I just want to beg everybody out there to not take the bone out of the leg of lamb before they roast it.
Oh, yeah,
absolutely.
You know,
leave it in. It's not that hard to work around.
you know, it's funny. Mark was, we recently, and I'm going to remind you, Mark, we had some people come in that were doing some hiring in the kitchen. If you know any great line cooks, and we thankfully are very busy and we need some help. But we had a guy do an interview, and we invite people into the kitchen and they demonstrate their knife skills. And Mark said something to the chef like, "So did he butcher that piece of meat with a pair of pliers, or did he use a knife?" So you can take that beautiful rib roast, and by the time it gets to your table, if it looks like pulled pork, you've done something wrong.
Exactly. And, you know, I wanted to mention to you guys, there was one thing we didn't get to roast that we were dying to, and that is, believe it or not, you guys will appreciate this, squirrel. We actually, for the West Virginia Thanksgiving story, that family in West Virginia includes squirrel, the same one that's running around in front of your front yard, on the table. And so we decided that we thought it would be a kick to really tell people what to do with squirrel at home.
How did you not get to that?
Because it's against the law to kill a squirrel in Brooklyn or New York.
Exactly. There you go. Well, I'm going to go out on a limb here and make a really big statement right on your radio show, which is there is no good mail order source for squirrel. We got many offers of folks who said, "Oh, well, I'll give you one out of the deep freeze so you could do your testing." But in the end, we couldn't find a really good mail order source for even from all kinds of great, you know, game meat mail order sources and things.
Yeah.
Nobody has squirrel, and so in the end, if we can't really provide it for folks, we don't want to encourage them to go out into their backyard and take it into their own hands. So we just ended up not including it. But it would have been so much fun as cooks. You know, we're so excited when we get to do something new. And I have to say, I've never tasted squirrel before, and I was heartbroken for days.
I have to say, when my dad and I used to go hunting as a kid, we would get squirrels, and you know, my mom would throw it into the. Well, my mom used to make.
Okay, now I know why you don't really like food. Okay, it's your mom's fault.
My mom used to throw everything into the huntsman stew, and I wish I had those things that my dad and I came, because we came home with pheasants and squirrels and cockbirds and all sorts of things, and my mother just threw it all.
So basically, you went out in the woods and shot everything that moved.
If it was edible, we
okay,
shot.
Okay, so is that what happened?
Well,
there goes a dragonfly. Get it.
Come on.
That's good eating. You have to eat a few of them. But.
Brooklyn boy. All right. So, but let's talk, give some helpful tips to our listeners. I find that when roasting things, you really need to be very, very careful about how spicing works. And a lot of the hard spices and the aromatic spices come into play. When you make a steak at home, that's going to be on the flame for a very short period of time and a very high heat, very dramatic. And you've got to penetrate that solid piece of meat. So people tend to season a steak, let's say, very aggressively on the outside, and to get that spiciness to penetrate. It's a different way that we spice things when we're roasting them in a pan over a long period of time, isn't it?
Absolutely. The other thing is, if you're grilling something, for instance, you're gonna end up losing a lot of the topical spices, anything you're sprinkling on it. You're gonna end up losing a good deal of that sort of down into the grate. So you over-season and over, you know, salt and spice and all that to make up for it. If you're roasting something for a long time, especially if you're going to be basting with the pan juices, which are going to hold any fallen spices and seasoning in, you do have to be, you know, you have to be aware of that. That being said, one of the greatest ways to season roasts is to do it ahead of time. People are so frightened to salt or something ahead of time or season it because of this idea that it's going to draw all the moisture out. Really, it's only going to do that to the very sort of outer portion of the meat. If you salted, for instance, one of my favorite roasting recipes is from Judy Rogers of Zuni Cafe in California. She salts a chicken 2 to 3 days in advance of roasting it. And all you do is salt it on the outside and in the cavity, throw it in the fridge, and let it sit. Well, by the time you roast it off, that flavor is all the way to the inside of the meat. And so people shouldn't be afraid to salt a bit ahead of time, even seasoning, say, a leg of lamb like we talked about. Leave it in the fridge for a few hours or overnight.
You know, when we come back, my mom had a roasting tip that she gave me when I first started in this business, and I'll talk to you guys about that in just a moment.
We'll be back in just a moment. 1450 WCTC time is 1145.
I think it's great that more and more restaurants are offering larger selections of wine by the glass. Unfortunately, I often find those by the glass wines flat or spoiled. It's been my experience that most wine preservation systems just don't work until now. The Vinfinity system was invented by Armando Luis, a mechanical engineer with over 25 years experience in the wine industry. Vinfinity has 3 US patents, but it's so simple I could kill myself for not inventing it first. Vinfinity creates a precise vacuum in the bottle that preserves the wine. Too much vacuum or too little and the wine is damaged. Vinfinity never needs gas and requires little maintenance. One Vinfinity system preserves any number of wines. We use just one system for both of our restaurants, and we're not alone. Some of the best restaurants in the country are taking on the Vinfinity system. The guest gets a large selection of wines by the glass in great condition, and the restaurant eliminates waste. Tell your favorite restaurant about it. If you own a restaurant, install it. Find out more at VinfinitySystem.com or call 201-988-5953.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys.
Hey everybody, welcome back. You're listening to the Restaurant Guys, and we're talking with Liz Pearson, who's the director of the Test Kitchen for Savour Magazine. We're talking about roasting mostly.
So Liz, right before the break, you were talking about one of the secrets that a lot of people use to roasting is salting even a couple of days in advance their birds. One of the things my mom did, and I'm starting to see more and more and more people do it, is she was constantly shoving something between the skin and the bird. You know, and she started with butter, and then if she wanted it to be herbed or spiced in a certain way, that stuff just went in between the skin and the bird and kind of roasted in there with the bird.
What's your take on that?
I love your mother.
We all love Mark's mother.
She's a smart woman. It's great because then it's right up against the meat. It's not going anywhere. It sort of has that protective covering of the skin. It's a great idea.
And something about being cooked in bubbling butter that just,
just makes you happy.
It's such a turn on.
Another trick with roasting, I think, too, that people are sometimes afraid to do is let your meat come up to room temperature a little bit before roasting it. So if you have, especially if you have a big piece like a standing rib roast or a leg of lamb, let it come out and sit on the counter, maybe covered in plastic wrap at room temp for a couple of hours before you put it in. That way you'll get much more even cooking instead of putting something that's ice cold into the oven and then having it cook from there. And same with even maybe a chicken. It's a much smaller piece of meat, so for a shorter time, but it doesn't hurt for things to be out. You're still going to cook them to a safe temperature at a high heat, and so they're going to be perfectly safe. But bring them out of the refrigerator for a bit before you put them in.
And it'll be easy to tell if it's spoiled because it'll start to stink.
Right.
Yeah, well, not 2 days in advance or anything. And the other thing is, of course, a good roasting rack. And we found that actually one of our editors is writing in the December issue about using foil, that you sort of coil up into an S or sort of a snake and use that as a roasting rack if you don't have a really sturdy one around. And that works great.
Sometimes
I use an upturned muffin tin and we'll roast the chicken on top of that.
Oh, that's good.
Just so everybody knows what we're talking about is when you put a roast in a pan, and, it expresses, some of that beautiful juice that you want in there. It's better to lift the bird up above that or whatever it is that you're roasting slightly.
You basically don't want the bottom of your bird boiling in its own fat there.
And you'll get much more even brown. You're much more likely to get some of that crispiness you're looking for on the bottom as well. And sort of the hot air can circulate around it more easily.
The other thing about roasting is when you'll see some people say, take a sprig of thyme and put it in. You think, well, one sprig of thyme for this whole big thing? It's a way to get the maximum extraction out of spices, because remember, we're extracting out of herbs and spices the whole time it's in there, and that's going into the pan juices that we're then putting on top of the bird or the roast or whatever it is, and that stays for a long time. And the other thing is, it's easy to make a sauce because you have pan drippings, and it's just, but again, what I want to encourage people to do is if you have a family that eats at home several nights a week, make a roast one night, and you think, oh, that's too much. It's not too much because it lives for days.
And I'll tell you, how many times have I seen the pan drippings at somebody's house go into the garbage and then somebody break out a can of Heinz gravy or something like that.
Isn't that terrible? You just sort of need to remove the fat off of it. Then you deglaze with either chicken stock or maybe wine or vermouth or something and let it thicken up a little bit. You have the perfect, easy, it's going to take on the same flavorings that you had in your roast, and it could not be easier to do.
So what should we be looking for in Savour Magazine now to prepare us for our autumn cooking season?
Well, aside from all the roasting, there's also, a great thing that comes with the holidays, which is sweets. And everyone has to, you're sort of required, I think, as a human being to eat double the sweets during the holidays. That's how we go in our family. And
Double for me would be very bad, Liz. That's
well,
a big
you're
number.
You're probably fully committed throughout the year, and I appreciate that. There actually are a lot of, we tested a lot of really great recipes for sweets, cakes. There's a great pumpkin roll in the November issue. And then also there's an entire feature in the December issue that's going to be devoted to candy making. And that we're talking about old-fashioned making lollipops, making peppermint patties from scratch, making toffee, candy bars, all that kind of great stuff. And actually, it's a feature that I got to write because that's what I grew up doing with my mother around the holidays. And so I feel like that's something people think candy making is too difficult to do at home, and it's really not. And showing up at a holiday party with a plate of candy as opposed to cookies that everyone else is bringing is so impressive. And it's just homemade candy, I think, just is inherently very, very special. And so you can definitely keep your eyes open for that.
It's great. During the holidays, my wife and I will take a shopping day or whatever, do whatever, and drop the kids off at the grandparents. And that's what they do during the day while they're with their grandparents is they make candy, and then that's the holiday candies that we use. And
is your family open to adoption?
Well, you know,
it wasn't a bad way to grow up, I'll be honest with you.
The interesting thing about making candy at home is, number one, it is something that you make. Which is, you know, I think that when you bring something to someone's house, to bring something that you make.
I totally agree.
Just like if you bring a bottle of wine you picked up in the liquor store, oh, gee, thanks. But if you picked up a bottle of wine that you've aged in your cellar for 4 or 5 years, that's interesting. Or a piece of cookie or cake or candy that you made. And the other thing is a lot of people are very concerned about, and I am one of them, trying to ingest as little high fructose corn syrup as possible. Now, if you look at the ingredients on most candy, you're going to find a lot of high fructose corn syrup as a sweetener. Well, if you make it at home, you probably don't have any high fructose corn syrup laying around. You're probably going to use sugar, and it's going to taste better.
Exactly. And you have so much more control over, you know, people are very particular about candy. I don't like coconut. I don't like this or that. Well, if there's some kind of candy that you really love, you can sort of adapt it at home. And I find that people who make candy, that sort of becomes their thing that they're famous for showing up with. Mm-hmm. You know, nobody else is making beautiful, thick, buttery pecan and chocolate-covered toffee and bringing it. I mean, you become a gem at any get-together you go to. I mean, I've been known to wrap those things up and give them as Christmas gifts to my own family who waits for that toffee or waits for that thing once a year, and that's their gift. And it really is, it's just so special. I'm a big baker myself, and candy making is just, to me, it's just sort of the next level. I think it's very, very special. Well, and we're glad. Unfortunately, we hadn't really covered a lot of candy making in the past, so we're really glad to bring that to readers.
Great.
In a simple way.
That's
Liz, correct. Liz, two things I want to say. Well, one is regarding the stuff that you make for Christmas. It's Mark and Francis, care of Stage Left Restaurant, 5 Livingston Avenue, New Brunswick, New Jersey. And second, we have to leave it there. There's always so much we could talk about. Will you come back and join us again?
Oh, my gosh. It'd be our pleasure. It'd be my pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Liz.
Liz Pearson, director of the Savor Magazine Test Kitchen. We'll be back in just a moment. 1450 WCTC time is 11:56.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC.
Hey, everybody, welcome back. It's Mark and Francis, the restaurant guys of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants, talking about holidays, roasting, holiday treats, and cookies.
Well,
I'm
know,
so happy to be here.
You know, Liz was talking about candy making, and something we do in our house all the time is I'll go and I'll grab some Valrhona chocolate. You know, Whole Foods sells it by the pound in the little tabs. It's very easy to melt. Basically, just boil a pot of water and put some kind of metal bowl over it and drop some chocolate in it. Slowly stir, melt your chocolate, and dip anything you want into it.
Pretzels, whatever.
Yeah, pretzels, graham crackers, cookies, anything you want, and you've got an instant, like, special dessert that's so much better than all those other snacks.
Let me tell you something.
Tell me something.
You know how we always say, listen, if you invite me over to your house, make me a hot dog, whatever. It's not, you know, people are like, oh, Francis is coming over. We'll make foie gras.
And chocolate-covered chocolate chip cookies.
It would be awesome. But I'll tell you what I do think is like, yeah, come on, you could have done better than that. When people say, well, we'll bring dessert or whatever to a party and people will bring their own desserts, and somebody makes
Chips
dinner,
Ahoy,
and they bring like an Entenmann's cake.
Mm-hmm.
Don't bring anything. You don't have me counting on it. But literally, you can take some pretzels, some good pretzels, and put melt some really good chocolate, and dip the pretzels in the chocolate, and you've made something.
Right, and you've made something great that's fun and delicious. Like I said, graham crackers, Oreo cookies, grab something out of your pantry that you. I guarantee you have something in there right now that if you dipped it in chocolate, you'd go, wow, that's really good.
Well, and the thing is, and all it takes is a little bit of effort to make it your own.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I do say buy good chocolate, and buy.
Right.
You know, I favor dark chocolate, but Valrhona chocolate you can get in most supermarkets.
Absolutely,
these days,
you can. Baker's chocolate and things like that, that's not going to be really special. But there are, even the supermarkets are selling some decent chocolate now. Melt a little bit, stick something in it.
And I have a tip for my late father, rest his soul. What we used to do
cashews.
when my mom would make this stuff for the holidays, we would all eat it before the holidays came,
mm-hmm.
and then they tried to freeze it out in the garage freezer, but frozen treats aren't that bad, we discovered.
Oh, I don't know if you know this. My mother froze everything like that. She loved frozen candy bars, frozen everything.
Well, what he wound up doing was instead of hiding it in the freezer, he had to eventually just keep it in the trunk of his car, which was good in the cold weather. It kept his kids away from it. Anyway, I hope you've enjoyed the hour listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Francis Schott.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are The Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. Time is 12 noon.